This podcast contains adult language and stories of true crime. If you don't like laughing, crying, or being horrified at the actions of other humans, this podcast is not for you.
Everyone, and welcome to season 4, episode 13, part 1 of Resolved Mysteries. This is the show where we rewatch, recap, and give you the latest updates to cases featured on the show Unsolved Mysteries. And I'm Eliza.
I'm Allison.
And I am Carlin.
And welcome to the show. As most of you know, for every review we receive, we donate a dollar to a different organization, and this month's is the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, suggested by our patron, Matthew. If you would like to be part of helping us select what nonprofits we donate to, you can join us on Patreon, where you'll also get access to ad-free episodes, 2 additional episodes a month, and early access to listener short stacks, along with goodies in the mail. And you can go to patreon.com/resolvemysteriespodcast to do that. We wanted to mention, we haven't mentioned it in a while, that we have merch.
We do.
And you can have some dick bitch cups. You can have some dick bitch totes. You can have magnets. You could have so many things. Mm-hmm. If you go to resolvemysteriespodcast.com/merch. We have our own merch page, and then that will also direct you to our TeePublic store, where you can get designs on truly anything you could ever want. Mm-hmm. So go there and buy something if you want to rep the show and help tell a friend about it.
Yeah.
Okay, what are we talking about in this episode in part 1 and 2?
In part 1, I have the unexplained death of Chad Maurer.
And a Lost Heirs segment about Laureen Roberts.
And then next week for part 2, I'll have a wanted segment about a con man, Todd Mueller.
And then I wrap it up with the Lost Love segment of Heath Vess.
All right. All right.
Let's do it. The first segment of season 4, episode 13 is a unexplained death segment, and it is the story of Chad Maurer. The segment begins in a late 80s, early 90s bicycle shop.
Oh, sure does. Sure does.
There are so many colorful windbreakers in the background.
Yes.
You got pink, you got purple, you got orange, you got yellow, and you got to get that windbreaker, but you got to get those matching swish pants.
You must.
Got to have them.
Because so you got to protect yourself from the wind in style.
And you have to make sure everyone can hear you coming when you're walking down the street.
Well, you need to swish those pants together to scare the wind away. I mean, that's how you break it.
Honestly, that's how they work.
In the early 90s, the wind was the biggest threat to all of us.
It truly was. So Robert Stack says that 19-year-old Chad Maurer worked in a bike shop in the Midwestern college town of Madison, Wisconsin. He was a typical boy next door, a popular and well-rounded athlete who hoped to save up enough money to attend college in Colorado. They show a photo of Chad.
Mm. Honey.
Honey.
Ladies. Peak 90s.
Very Zach Morris vibes.
He looks like a friend of David Silver on 90210.
Mm-hmm. He had sun in. He definitely had sun in his hair.
Yes.
Oh, he's got that white sweater. He's got that comb over, like, skater, surfer guy haircut.
Side part.
Oh, side part. Mm-hmm. On the afternoon of May 19th, 1990, Chad returned home to grab a quick lunch, and it would be the last time Chad's parents would ever see him. Dolly Maurer, Chad's mom, said there was nothing about him that was different. He wasn't on edge. He was so excited about the job, and he had a big smile on his face as usual. John Maurer said that he didn't think Chad was behaving any differently and that he doesn't think that he had any intentions of going anywhere beside work because he didn't take a jacket with him and it was cool that day. Dolly Maurer says that about an hour to an hour and a half later, John needed something at the hardware store, and the hardware store was two doors down from the bike shop, so she and John went to the hardware store and noticed Chad's car wasn't in the parking lot. So they went into the bike shop to see where Chad was. So in the reenactment, Dolly asks the owner of the bike shop where Chad is and tells him his car is out front. George, the owner, tells her, quote, "Well, he'd better be here. Maybe he has a customer in the back." And Dolly said that she immediately knew something was wrong, but that she and John went home to wait for Chad. We'll get into how weird that is later. It's like, what? Dolly says that she hardly got any sleep that night, only 5 hours, which I have in my notes is more sleep than I get on my best day.
So. I was going to say, Allison will be jealous.
I'm like, only 5 hours, honey.
Dolly must have been getting 10 on a usual basis.
Seriously. So Dolly woke up at 6 and started calling all of Chad's friends at 7:30. And she does say in the interview, "I woke up at 6, but I knew none of them would be awake, so I waited until 7:30, which is very sweet of her. She started calling his friends at 7:30 to see if anyone knew where Chad was, but in the interview, it seems like she already knew that they were all going to say that they had no idea. Dolly said that the last time any of his friends had seen him was on that Friday night at a party for a couple hours, and that was it. So then the segment jumps to Chicago. And Stack tells us that the south side of Chicago is one of the roughest neighborhoods in the country. Here's a fun fact. Not only didn't Chicago make the 2021 Forbes list for worst neighborhoods in the United States, but guess which city did? Portland.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
The block group delimited by the Steel Bridge, the Willamette River, Fremont Bridge, North Russell Street, North Williams Avenue, North Thompson Street, and Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard, which is basically the Moda Center north up to the Fremont Bridge near MLK, had the most violent crimes, one of the most violent crimes per year at 181.
Yeah.
And the violent crime rate is 210 crimes per 1,000 residents.
Oof.
In that top 10 list, all of the other neighborhoods were in L.A., San Francisco, and Kansas City. So we only made the list once, but we made the list. Chicago did not make the list at all.
And New York.
Yeah.
New York is
safe now.
Very safe. Very safe.
Oh, wait. This is now.
This is this year.
Oh.
Yeah, so it's Portland. Yeah,
it's been bad.
And then neighborhoods in L.A., San Francisco, and Kansas City.
Got it. Sorry. Yeah.
Well, the police here have been a little busy doing some other stuff that they think is more important.
And they're also woefully understaffed. So Stack tells us that Chicago's South Side is just a three-hour drive from Madison, Wisconsin. 2 days after Chad was last seen, a maintenance worker found his car abandoned in a garage of a South Side apartment complex. Chad Maurer was inside the car. Apparently, he had died from carbon monoxide poisoning. Chicago police contacted the Maurers with the tragic news that their son had committed suicide, which, right from the jump, doesn't make a lick of sense. If you found a young man in a garage with a license plate from Wisconsin, you're immediately going to think he drove all the way to Chicago to take his life, or I would guess accidental death. I'm not even saying they should have thought it was foul play.
Right.
I just would have thought it was an accidental death.
And when do they show us those photos? Is it now or is it later?
You can talk about them now. It's about this time.
Yeah, so they show what I believe are the actual photos.
Like, yes,
they do.
They
do a recreation of that scene as well.
Right.
But they show us prints of photos that look to be real. And the way that body is splayed does not look to me
like
a suicide.
I think I have one of the photos. But his body is essentially halfway in the front seat and halfway in the back seat. So the top part of his body is in the back seat of the car, his legs and torso are kind of in the front seat, and he's curled over, and it does not look like he sat in a garage and slowly inhaled carbon monoxide until he fell asleep.
Right. Nope.
And then also, I read an article that Chad had just brought in a bike wheel to be repaired days before he disappeared and had planned to attend a concert the day he was found. So it's not exactly the general behavior of someone who's about to take their own life, but also, who knows?
Yeah.
I read that anywhere from 1/3 to 80% of all suicide attempts are impulsive acts, according to the New England Journal of Medicine. 24% of those who made near lethal suicide attempts decided to kill themselves less than 5 minutes before the attempt. And 70% made the decision within an hour. Mm. So, concert tickets notwithstanding, people have taken their own lives with plans for their future.
Which is why guns are so dangerous to have in your home. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So Dolly is interviewed, and she says that her brain went into shock and that she wasn't thinking until, quote, the kids started calling. She says that they were calling and saying that there was no way that Chad took his own life. They said that he had too much going on for him. He had a lot of friends, and he loved life. Dolly says that Chad was not depressed, Chad was not down, and he had a lot of goals.
The way she described the kids calling is so sad.
It's heartbreaking.
Because she's having to decide what to say to them when she's just found out about her own son. Mm-hmm. And what is she saying to them? I know? Or is she trying to say, I know it's hard to understand, but like... she's having to console them.
And she said a lot of them were like yelling about it. Like, yes. Disagreeing.
The quote is screaming.
Yeah.
Ugh. She said they were screaming. She began to say a sentence where she said, well, it's carbon monoxide. And then she's cut herself off because I think she was initially trying to tell them, well, it was carbon monoxide.
Yeah.
And the friends were screaming or yelling back, no, there's no way that he
took
his own life.
That is so upsetting.
It's yeah,
so
upsetting. It really is. And it does really seem like he had this group of friends and he was just out of high school, so there wasn't time for those friendships to kind of fall by the wayside.
Right.
It was just brand new. Mm-hmm.
Brand new young adults with plans.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yep.
So this is also something really sad, and I will always call it out. I don't care if we do this for 12 seasons. These parents play themselves in the reenactment.
Yes. Yep.
And this scene is particularly devastating because the reenactment is John and Dolly viewing Chad's body for the first time just prior to the funeral.
Yeah. Yep.
So Stack says that they were startled by his appearance. While the Chicago police had said there was no evidence of foul play, the knuckles on both hands had been skinned to the bone. And there were bruises on his face. So I'm interspersing some articles that I read. I read that the Mowers were shocked at what they saw. A cut, bruised face, deep bruises in the groin area.
Oh.
A swollen lower lip cut by his own teeth. Skin scraped to the bone on both knuckles. Blood on the back of his shirt. And then drag marks on the seat of his pants.
Just
when they looked
obviously
at the clothing.
Beat up.
Yes. Absolutely.
Like, what authorities in any world can say that looks like a suicide?
Yes. Well, I didn't even get into the Chicago police at the 1990s, but in all kindness, it was a nightmare to be a police officer in Chicago in the 1990s.
Sure.
The crime rate was astonishingly high.
Yeah.
Obviously, it was lazy work.
Mm-hmm.
And it did garner a lot of attention because, sadly, he was a white kid from Madison, who ended up dead.
Yeah.
So the Chicago police tried to brush this off, but basically nobody let them. It wasn't just the people involved in this segment. Mm-hmm. They were being held accountable all over the place. They were held to task by a lot of people. So Chad's fathers were shown the clothes that Chad was wearing when he was found. And Chad's father says that he could not understand why there were bloodstains on the T-shirt. And in the reenactment, the shirt is fully covered in blood. Mm-hmm. It is saturated.
Mm-hmm.
And I read later that this is an accurate depiction.
Mm.
I read a statement by someone who saw the shirt, and they verified that the shirt had blood all over it.
Mm.
So like you said, I can't imagine a police officer looking at that much blood and thinking that there wasn't a crime committed.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I'm not even really going to get into it as we move forward. There are a lot of cries of police corruption and police cover-up. This is a classic example of ineptitude and laziness.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is not – no one is trying to cover up his murder. But do you know why? Because the Chicago police at that time were too busy to cover up his murder. They truly just didn't care. They were too overwhelmed. So I'm not entertaining any – we're not going to have a lot of discussion about police cover-up in this segment because it's just – it's too ambitious.
Yeah.
So now convinced that Chad's death wasn't a suicide, the Mowers contacted the local authorities. And together with Detective David Bongiovanni – the most Jersey name that ever Jerseyed. I don't know what he's doing living in Wisconsin because he belongs with me and my people. they studied the police report filed in Chicago. So John and Dolly immediately noticed yet another suspicious clue. Next to Chad in the back seat was a jacket. And if you remember in the reenactment, Dolly asked Chad to take a jacket and he laughed at her and said, I'm just going to work. So he explicitly did not take a jacket.
Yeah.
So Dolly goes on to say that not only had Chad not taken a jacket with him, but that he did not own a jacket like the one in the crime scene photo. Bongiovanni says that it would be interesting to have known the size of the jacket, the brand of the jacket, or literally anything about the jacket, which could have led them to where it was purchased, which could have led them to the killer, or later, now we know, DNA in a myriad of different ways. But when he checked with Chicago PD, they had noted the jacket as well, but they were not sure where the jacket was, but they were going to check into that. And then we switch over to Sergeant John Ridges of the Chicago PD Violent Crimes Unit. And I do have to say that he is eating a lot of humble pie in this segment. He knows that they messed up.
Yeah.
He's very absolutely knows it. He's trying to be as diplomatic as possible. But I think that I think it's easy for us to tell that he is equally as frustrated. So he believes that the jacket was probably left in the car overnight, before it was towed in the garage. After all of these police officers were there, they left the car unattended. And before it was towed, someone took the jacket out of the unlocked car. I know. He says he wishes that they had the jacket, but they have no jacket. And then I read in a Chicago Tribune article that the Mowers said that the investigators from Chicago and Madison never examined a window of Chad's car that had appeared to be smudged with bloody fingerprints.
Oh, my God.
Jeez.
And then this is what John Ridges said in an article I read. It probably could have been done better. There were some problems, but the Kennedy assassination could have been handled better, too.
Oh, my God.
On one hand, yeah, we messed up. On the other hand, he's like, but I don't want you to give me a hard time about it.
He's like, other people have also messed up before.
Other people have made mistakes.
And did we ever find the second gunman on the grassy knoll? No. And I don't hear you complaining about that. So here are some quotes from him from an article that I read. Quote, it had the earmarks of a suicide. The ignition was on, the battery was dead, and the gas tank was empty. The problem was the victim didn't fit the suicide victim profile. If he was going to commit suicide, why would he drive 150 miles to do it? Quote, if you want to be a Monday morning quarterback, I think there were problems. But I don't think anyone screwed up intentionally. In response, Dolly Maurer says, Chicago was as criminally negligent as the criminals in this case. They never really asked us or did anything about Chad. So Stack says that the autopsy report also suggested that Chad had not taken his own life. The level of carbon monoxide in his body was 74%, a figure much higher than usually found in a suicide, which I didn't know. But this is really interesting. Bongiovanni says that the levels at which a conscious person succumbs to carbon monoxide poisoning is 50 to 60%. When the levels get to 75 or 80%, that's more consistent with a person being unconscious or sleeping at the time. That's because people have a tendency to breathe deeper and more methodically when they're sleeping or unconscious. I thought that was fascinating. So I also read an autopsy conducted by the Cook County Medical Examiner, which ruled the manner of death undetermined, cited 6 hand and facial bruises. It said, however, at the time, there was no other evidence of trauma. But in Madison, the Dane County Coroner's Office, at the request of the local sheriff's department, looked at Chad and found other bruises, including those in the mouth and groin. Roy Dames, executive director of the Cook County office, downplayed the differences. Quote, is it really important to make a note of every single mark? If he had 100 marks or 125 marks, does it really make a difference? It was carbon monoxide poisoning. The doctor found bruises and did note them, and they bothered him, Dames said. He said, gee, somebody should investigate it. And I think that we did everything that we were supposed to do.
How does that comment not get him fired? Oh, my God.
Yeah. Stax, as the cause of Chad's death, was changed from suicide to undetermined. Authorities began a full-blown investigation, however, probably against the opinion of Roy Thames, who didn't believe that you shouldn't make a note of every single groin bruise in a carbon monoxide suicide case.
Okay. So
I know.
Even it's very frustrating. Even if it was carbon monoxide, that does not explicitly mean it's a suicide.
Yeah. Right. And it was carbon monoxide, but no. He was beat to unconsciousness before that.
All the other
Therefore,
factors play in.
It is like, still homicide. Jesus
which is why Christ. You write every marking yes. on the body down.
And who wants to hear a coroner say, are you really going to mark everything Truly. Down?
That's what I mean. How is he not immediately fired?
Yeah. Not only was he not fired, but I did a little bit of research into Roy Thames.
Oh, no.
And he was much loved and passed away. People just, I guess this is just how he was. I don't know. I was expecting to find some other articles about where he generally didn't give a shit, but I didn't find anything. And when he passed away, everybody had nothing but good things to say about him. So maybe it was a one-off. Maybe he was having a bad day. We'll give him a little bit of grace. So the bike shop owner was quoted in a local newspaper about the case. So Stack is talking kind of over this reenactment. And in the reenactment, the shop owner is having a conversation with Detective Bongiovanni. And in the background, you hear him say, quote, someone or something spooked him. And then Stack says that 9 days after the bike shop owner gave his quote to the newspaper, the bike shop was vandalized.
Right.
And by vandalized, Stack means that someone shot the windows out.
Yeah.
I was thinking graffiti.
Yeah.
I don't consider shooting the windows of a building out vandalizing.
Yeah, I had that same thought.
So Stack says that no other store in the area was vandalized, so it appeared that someone was sending a message. However, I read in a 2015 Wisconsin State Journal news article that was the point where Bongiovanni was assigned to the case. Because he was actually a narcotics officer, not a homicide detective. Mm. So they thought that the shooting was related to narcotics dealing. So that's when he joined. But pretty soon after he joined, the shots to the window were quickly determined to not be part of the Chad Mirror case. But Bongiovanni stayed on the case anyway because he had connections in Chicago and he knew that something was amiss with what Chicago had done.
Mm.
So, on October 22nd, 1990, Chad's story was aired on a local Crime Stoppers program in Madison, and a disturbing scenario emerged. After the broadcast, an anonymous tip alleged that Chad was involved in a drug deal with some people who lived in his apartment complex in Madison. These same people had previously lived on the south side of Chicago. Sergeant John Ridges says that they do know there's a pipeline of drug trafficking from Chicago to Madison, but he admits that there's nothing in Chad's background that would suggest that he would be involved with narcotics. He says that the tox report even came back clean and that Chad didn't even have alcohol in his system. But because of this connection to his neighbors, it is possible that he may have been tricked or enticed in some way to be involved in narcotics trafficking. And then I read on a sitcoms online forum, someone said that his neighbors in the apartment complex were sort of like wannabe like gangsters, like kind of wannabe thug kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
And that he had become friends with these people in the apartment complex that he moved into separately from his high school friends and the people that were calling his mother.
Mm-hmm.
So Detective Bongiovanni says, it's possible someone offered Chad money to make the trip to the south side. Chad was looking to make money to move to Colorado. He said it's possible that they offered to pay him to make the trip, and when he got to Chicago, the people reneged on the offer, and an altercation occurred that led to Chad being killed. And then the reenactment, they show a group of men beating up Chad and then putting him in his car and closing the garage door, which was really interesting because I hadn't even thought about that. I thought that his murder was intentional, but that kind of makes you think, oh, they beat this guy up,
yeah.
and they put him in the car to leave him there, but they... I don't think they intentionally were like, if we close the garage door, we're going to give him carbon monoxide poisoning.
So he just happened to have gotten out and his car was still running and
yeah.
put him back in.
That's what I think.
Oh.
Like, that's kind of, I could see, that to me is the most plausible scenario.
Hmm.
So I don't think that they were like, let's stage this or let's.
And he was knocked out already, you're saying? Okay.
Yeah, I think they beat the shit out of him. They threw him in his car. He was unconscious. And then they closed the door so that nobody would see what was going on. And they didn't realize that that would inevitably kill him.
Which makes it worse. That makes it even worse that the police thought it was a suicide.
Yeah.
Because it's like someone wasn't even trying to stage it that
no.
way.
No. There was nothing clever about it. It was just, I think, a bunch of guys that beat the crap out of him and threw him in the car and figured he'll drive home. He'll go back to Madison and he won't tell anybody. Mm. I don't think they were thinking five steps ahead of, and then they're going to think he took his own life.
Yeah.
They weren't doing that. They were like drug dealers and they would just beat the shit out of a white kid, you know? Sergeant Ridges says that almost all homicides in Chicago are drug related. Whether they're selling it, fighting over territory, or using it, so that's the reason that the police are inclined to lean toward the drug angle. Ridges says that law enforcement believe that there are people in the Madison area that probably know more than they are coming forward with, and they need to know why Chad was in that garage. Dolly says that all they know is Chad is dead, and that he ended up in Chicago, and they know that he was beaten up. She says there are so many questions. And she says she knows it won't bring Chad back, but they can't rest until they have answers to the case. And there is no update.
No.
So we know what that means.
Yeah.
This is a head scratcher. There is a lot going on here. So initially, before I started researching, I was having a hard time wrapping my head around the timeline and then the events in that timeline. So Chad was last seen by his friends at a party on Friday night. Then he went to work on Saturday morning. He came to his parents for lunch because Stack's his home, but Chad lived in a different apartment,
right,
separate from his parents in another part of town.
Weird.
He arrived at his parents and he's driving. The Mustang was his father's car, yeah, not his car.
That's what I was, that the whole time I thought he lived at home.
Me too.
He did not live at home. The car was not his. And then, and this is what got me, he asks for gas money.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So I looked it up, and the distance from Chad's parents' home to the Village Peddler is 3 miles, give or take, which is nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Not only is it strange that he would have to stop for gas, especially because he's in a rush, right? He's got a sandwich in his mouth. He's running out the door. Mm-hmm. And as of today, when I looked, there are no gas stations on the most direct route that Chad would have taken back to work from his parents' house. The 4 closest gas stations are off of major highways. So he would have had to basically get off smaller streets, go to the highway, get gas, and then get back, and then get to work.
Mm-hmm.
3 miles. Mm-hmm. That just doesn't seem, I thought that was strange.
Yeah, I mean, I guess he could be like, I'm going to need gas soon. I'll see if my dad will give me some cash. I don't know.
Yeah, I guess. I just remember being 18 years old and truly driving until my fucking car was completely empty.
Oh, I pretty much still do that.
I just can't imagine this kid in the middle of his workday rushing home for lunch, having enough foresight to be like, oh, I'm going to be driving 3 miles.
Yeah.
I'm definitely going to need to gas up my car.
You're saying that means you think he knew he was driving to Chicago.
Yes. Yeah. That's what I think. I don't know if he knew that he was driving to Chicago that afternoon. I think he may have thought he was going after his work shift, but I think he definitely had an intention to drive out of the neighborhood of where his work was and where his parents lived. So then Chad tells his parents he's returning to work, and his parents find a reason to visit him, which I think is so cute. His dad's like, oh, I really need this thing from the hardware store. And Dolly's like, oh, I guess we gotta go and like peek in on our son who's like super stoked about his new job. Yeah. I thought that was really sweet. So his parents go to the store and they ask the owner if Chad is there. And the owner says he better be. In this reenactment, this is the busiest little bike store that ever existed. There's people just everywhere. Everyone wanted a bike that day.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen the store. It's large, but it's not like a Walmart.
Yeah.
It's not acres and acres of store. It's just a store.
Yeah.
It's not that deep. And the owner didn't check to see if he came back from his lunch break. And he dismisses them and says, oh, he's probably in the back with a customer. So, like, we never know, and you're never able to find out, if the owner knew if he was there or not, if the owner saw him, if he ever made it back.
Hmm.
And then, presumably, Chad disappears at that point because we don't know where he is, or we don't know if he's still at work, but he's probably not.
Shift?
I would be like, oh, then I'm going to go in the back and look. Where's my kid?
Yeah.
So they go home and wait for him. again, the Mustang wasn't Chad's, it was his father's. So here's what's super messed up. I think if his dad would have called the Mustang in stolen, they may have found Chad a lot faster rather than trying to report an 18-year-old man missing.
That's like the Matthew Chase case, remember? His friend is like, well, I'm just going to say he stole my car because then they'll look for him.
So smart.
And I know that's why John didn't call the police, because then Chad would have been arrested for theft. Oof. But it would have been better than waiting until Monday.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so what fully doesn't make sense is when did he – there is no timeline as to when he actually went missing.
Yeah.
We don't know if he finished his shift without his boss seeing him and then went, or did he take off in the middle of the day? I mean, and it doesn't seem like Chad would have risked getting fired from this job. He had only had it for a few days. Mm. And he had run into some issues after high school and lost a job and was really excited to have this job. And even though he could have made a lump sum for his Colorado moving fund, I can't imagine it was enough money that he's like, cool, and now I'll just quit my job and go to Chicago. I mean, go to Colorado tomorrow.
After a few days as a clerk at a bike store.
Yeah, exactly. So then, like I said, I read in a 1991 Chicago Tribune article that life after high school posed some problems for Chad. He lost his job, so he had to sell a motorcycle and a television set to finance his weekend getaways to the Wisconsin slopes. So there's photos of him snowboarding. Yeah. He was a BMX guy in the air doing all these crazy tricks. And the other issue, according to his mother, was that he smoked too much marijuana.
Ooh.
Yes.
As those extreme sports boys do.
You know how they do, those boys in Colorado. They do it so much, they made it legal, and that's great. So there were a ton of theories at the time. Maurer was a courier for Chicago Madison narcotics ring, that he came to Chicago looking for gay sex.
Oh.
That he was in Chicago to buy drugs for himself and met with Pal Play, that he was simply the wrong place at the wrong time, a victim of random violence, or that he was, in fact, depressed and suicidal. In an article, Dolly Maurer said, I really can't tell you what happened to my kid, but I think suicide is out of the question. Others who knew Chad Maurer agreed. Quote, I think he was on the run from something, said George Godfrey, the owner of the Village Peddler. It was unlike him to leave without saying anything. The next thing we heard, he turns up dead in Chicago. He was a good kid. He was an honest kid and a good racer. Along with other possible explanations, another is that Maurer was abducted by someone desiring to get to Chicago in a hurry, who then killed him on arrival, or that he may have agreed to give someone a ride for a price and then was killed on arrival. But no matter what the circumstances are, it's not an unexplained death. It's a murder, because everyone who knew Chad knew that he wouldn't take his own life. One of his close friends, David Sliff, played tennis with Maurer the day before he disappeared. And he said, quote, Chad wanted to race mountain bikes in Colorado. He was putting away money and had his whole future planned. There was nothing odd about his behavior at all. He was more up than most people. Every once in a while, I still want to just call him and ask him to play tennis with me. Mrs. Maurer said in an interview, we think about Chad and what happened to him every day. We've got to keep talking about it or John and I would lose our sanity. We have to keep pushing law enforcement people. It would be a discredit to him and ourselves not to do it. Even if we don't come to peace, maybe Chad can rest in peace. He's the one who lost his life. We're just the walking wounded. When you lose your only child, 1 foot of ours is already in the grave. We're just not the same people, and we never will be. Our love for Chad just keeps us going, and all of our good memories, no matter how bad it gets or how the case comes out, it will never take away those memories. Cope is the word. We don't live, we just cope. In 2015, a reporter with the Wisconsin State News Journal who was friends with Dolly checked in on her on the 21st anniversary of Chad's death. And here is a little of what he wrote about her. Quote, Dolly has operated a home cleaning business for 35 years. She enjoys the work and counts her clients as her closest friends. Quote, I love my people. Chad's parents divorced in 2007, and this time of year, the anniversary is always difficult. Quote, May is bad, Dolly said. She has coping mechanisms, however. On the anniversary, she always makes all of his favorite foods.
Aww.
I also read in the article that Dolly has a vanity license plate that says Chad M. and she keeps a photo of Chad in her car's rear window and also on her keychain. Mm-hmm. And I found Dolly on Facebook. She is a honey. She is so sweet. She posted for Chad's 30th anniversary of Chad's disappearance. She posted a lot of photos of him that I'm going to share with everyone. And she is fully into Elvis and this Elvis impersonator called Tony Rocker. And she goes to see him live all of the time.
Oh my gosh, I love her.
She posts about it and she says how whenever she's feeling sad, she goes to see Tony Rocker with her friends and that he keeps her from being depressed. And it is freaking cutest thing in the world.
I love her.
I am so sad for her that she never got any justice or any closure for the death of her son.
Terrible.
Yeah. And that's it. I think that's all we're going to get.
I know.
It's a bummer because I do agree that there are some people in Madison who knew more than what they were saying and haven't come forward.
Yeah.
And maybe they were afraid. But I was just listening to the Murder Squad. Mm-hmm. And Paul Holes said something really interesting about people not coming forward later in life or wanting to cooperate with the police. And he said, well, you know, these people, things happen when they're young and then they marry and they have families and children.
Yeah.
He's like, they're not bad people. They just don't
want. But to come out and say you've known something like this for 30 years and never said anything.
And that the reason why this person died was because you gave them drugs to sell and they got ripped off.
Yep.
What will your kids think of you? And what will the people in your community think of you? I thought that was a really interesting point. It isn't just like, come forward.
It's so easy. Yeah.
Yeah. Because it probably isn't for these
people. It's not easy, but it is still the right thing to do. And everyone still needs to do it.
Oh, absolutely. I fully agree. There is some reason behind it besides pure selfishness or disregard for the victim.
Yeah. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm with you. Like, I do not think it was a suicide. I do think there was an element of this that something went wrong. I don't think it was necessarily supposed to be a murder.
Yeah. Someone I read in the comment section on Sitcoms Online, someone had an interesting point. Because they didn't know if Chad went back to work, he may have gone back to work. And while he was at work, maybe someone came to see him and said, hey, I need to get to Chicago. I'll give you $500 if you take me right now or something like that. Yeah. One of the people from the apartment complex or in a circle of friends. So that would make sense, maybe. I don't know. You know, there's so many theories, but yes, he was absolutely murdered. The question is, how did he get there?
Yeah.
And what was he involved in that got him that way?
Right. But even if he was knowingly involved in something, like, he's a kid from the Midwest who didn't know what he was getting into. Like,
nobody deserves to be murdered because they ran drugs.
Mm-mm. Right. Mm-mm.
I don't care if it was kilos of cocaine. But I think probably what happened was he got there and they were supposed to give him money. And instead of giving him money, they beat the shit out of him.
Yeah.
I know kids that happened to that I went to high school with, but nobody put them in a car.
Right.
Nobody left them in a garage. So I really do think they were just going to rip him off. And he ended up dead because the engine was still running.
Right. That is so
tragic.
Sad.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really sad.
Oh. Well, good job.
Are you guys ready to talk about our honey, Laureen?
Oh my gosh, yes. This one's nice.
It's a lost heirs, but it's also a lost loves.
Yes.
Very much. Stack starts by telling us stats about homeless people, which turns out to have nothing to do with the segment. But he does tell us some statistics. He says estimates of their numbers go as high as 3 million in the United States alone.
Is that right? Did you check?
I don't think that's right, because today's numbers from 2020 were 580,466.
That's it?
I was surprised that that amount was that small.
Wow.
But I don't think 3 million was right. Huh. Unless, like, I'm not taking something major into account. I don't know.
Interesting.
And he says, sadly, many of us tend not to see the individuals in the faceless masks. We forget that for each man, woman, and child on the streets, there's an untold story. And that's nice, because that's true.
It is true.
And Stack tells us that this is the story of Lorene Roberts, who may be lost among the homeless. Her family has not seen or heard from her in more than 30 years. Lorene has no way of knowing that she's one of the heirs to a $1 million estate. They then show Lorene in a picture from her high school basketball team. Stack tells us she was also in the pep club. And when she was 16, she kind of unexplainedly dropped out of school. And her family thinks that this is when she kind of started a slow descent into mental illness. So Lorene's sister, Virginia Turner, is interviewed, and she says that Lorene was quiet. She'd keep to herself most of the time and was sort of in her own little world. Virginia says it's as if she wasn't there with you most of the time. And then we have a really disgusting reenactment of how Lorene met her husband.
Ew. Oh, my God.
So creepy.
We hate it.
Hate it.
We hate it. I'm not sure with the timeline because they don't really give us, like, birth dates, but I'm thinking this is the 50s, and Lorene is in a waitressing uniform. She's at a restaurant she's working at. There's a soldier sitting at one of the tables, and he says, "Hey, hey, little lady, can we get some coffee over here?" But, like, he says it like that. He doesn't say it nice.
No.
And Lorene looks up, and she's confused, and he says, "Yeah, you, the pretty one." Again, says it aggressively like that.
Yes.
He's like, "Want to take our order?" And in case we didn't already want to barf, she's taking his order, and he says, while pointing his finger in her face, "Write that down. Coffee, pie, and how about I take you for a whirl?"
I didn't know what that meant either. I thought that was like a sex thing.
So did I. Especially because he's saying it very aggressively.
Yeah, I was like, is he saying that he's going to have sex with her here now? What's going on?
And she, you can tell, is like mixed confusion because she's like, this guy is paying attention to me and he's...
Yeah.
You know, she, like, simultaneously, I think, is flattered and, like, confused by how he's acting.
He's paying attention to me, but he's treating me like garbage.
Yeah, so he says, "I'm going to take you for a whirl." And she's like, "Well, I don't know what that means." Because I think she's thinking like you, like, "Wait, what?"
Ew.
And then he's like, "Let me show you." And then he swoops in and starts dancing with her in the restaurant.
I hate it.
Of course they fall in love and get married because who can resist that kind of toxic masculinity?
Yes, honey. I was just going to say that.
10 days after meeting,
they are married. If it was me, I'd still be thinking about how douchey those comments were 10 days later. Like, yeah. I wouldn't
still,
be like,
be
swoon. But sadly, I think that shows us a little bit of Lorene's mental state at the time.
Yeah.
So they end up having 3 children in quick succession. And then in 1956, they moved to her husband's hometown in New Jersey. So Ruby Bowles is one of Lorene's other sisters, and she's also interviewed, and she says Lorene told her she was not happy in New Jersey. His family did not accept Lorene, but they don't really get into, like, what that means. And apparently being a dick bitch runs in the family because his mother bought Lorene and the children a train ticket back to Austin.
Disgusting.
So, yeah, she's like, get out of Jersey, sends them back to Austin on a train, and...
With her grandchildren.
That's what I was going to say. Like, it's one thing to be, like, telling him, like, you know what? I don't think she's the right fit for you. But
to send your own grandkids away, you are, like, a true evil lady.
Yes.
Disney villain.
So Stack says that Lorene and her 3 little kids returned to Texas not knowing what they were going to do. So they have the saddest scene of Lorene. She's, like, getting ready to leave for work. She's got her waitress uniform on. The house is in disarray. All the kids are coming to her with questions, needing something. She's trying to leave, and she puts the 5 or 6-year-old in charge because she has no other option. And I just hate this husband and his mother so much. Mm-hmm. Like, what did they think they were going to do?
Mm-hmm.
Ruby says that Lorene loved her 3 children, but she decided she just could not handle the situation. There was no help from her husband, so Lorene decided it would be best to put the children up for adoption so they'd be taken care of.
And that scene with her telling her oldest, like, you have to be in charge, you have to be the man while I'm gone, is just so sad.
It's so sad. So she puts the kids up for adoption. Clearly, she does not want to do this. But how is she supposed to have three kids on a waitress income? Like,
yep.
So Stack says after the kids were adopted, Lorene's mental health declined. Ruby says she came to her and admitted she was sick and needed a doctor. So their dad asked Ruby to take Lorene to the psychiatrist. She did, and he admitted her to the state hospital. Ruby says she cried and hugged her neck and loved her, and it was so hard to have to leave her there. And I'm just like, the dad making Ruby do this is not okay.
No.
Between 1957 and 1961, Lorene was admitted to the state mental hospital 5 different times. Every time Lorene got out, she'd get a job as a waitress, but after a short matter of time, as they said, the pressure would become too much and she'd need to be checked back in again. One day in 1959, when Lorene was between hospital stays, she showed up unannounced at Ruby's house. She was in a cab.
Oh my God. This is the saddest.
Ruby is like very surprised. She's like, oh my God, Lorene, like it's so good to see you. Come tell me how you're doing. Lorene says she's getting married. And Ruby says, that's wonderful. Who are you getting married to? And she says, a college professor. And she's very like aloof and like.
Yes.
She seems very strange.
Numb kind of.
Yes.
Yeah.
Or like dissociative.
Yeah.
Yes. So she says, college professor, she says, that's great. Where did you meet him? And she ignores this question and starts talking about how pretty her ring is. And then she asks Lorene again. She says, Lorene, where did you meet him? And she says, the college.
Ugh.
Ruby says she just didn't question her and she just hoped for the best. So, and then Lorene is like, I'm going to go now, and gets back in her cab. Then Ruby is interviewed, and she's now in her 70s probably, and she says that was the last time she ever saw or heard from Lorene. So, and then 2 weeks later, Ruby received a bill for Lorene's engagement ring.
Yeah.
Lorene had bought it herself and hadn't made any payments.
Which, how did they know, how did they do that? That they knew Ruby was, like, next of kin or whatever to pay for it?
I know, I almost wondered if she put down her card or something. I don't know. I have no idea. Eric Tucker, the family's attorney, says there's been no record of Lorene for the past 25 years. Then he tells us that her mother died in 1988, and her will stated that her estate, which was about $1 million, was left to her children.
I have a question. Sorry.
Yeah.
If her estate is $1 million, because I thought this while we were watching, I was watching the segment. She's a millionaire.
Mm-hmm.
Why was she living with her children and had to give her children away? Like, what was happening there?
Why wasn't her family helping her? Right.
$1 million?
And think, too, about how, like, Ruby was very surprised when Lorene showed up to her house. So I think Lorene was really not being involved with them and, like, not contacting them a lot and kind of doing her own thing. But, yeah. I know, like that's that same still thought.
That's the other grandma. The one grandma was mean mm-hmm. and sent them away.
Yeah.
The other grandma didn't know that she couldn't. She was going to give these children away because she couldn't afford to keep them, and she has $1 million. That's so sad.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe
the family knew like her mental state wasn't okay, and like maybe it was the best thing for the children. I'm not sure.
Oh.
So. He says that since they didn't know where Lorene was, he was appointed to represent her and try to locate her. So he says that he really believes Lorene is out there somewhere, either on the street or in a hospital or under some new identity, but he thinks she is out there. Lorene's sisters then both talk about how she had left a void when she disappeared and they really want her back. And the way they talk about her the whole time is very loving. Like, I don't think any of them were trying to push her away or anything.
No, they love her so much.
Yeah. Ruby says she'd tell her about her children and grandchildren who have found them, and that would be the first thing she'd want her to know. So this is like a double lost loves. The children were lost. They already found the family, except for Lorene.
Yeah.
So that was the end of the segment. Then Stack is edited back in with an update, and he says, when we aired the story, we never imagined that Lorene would call our telecenter and solve her own mystery. Lorene was alive and well in Little Rock, Arkansas. Eric Tucker was wrong. She wasn't houseless, and she was working as a housekeeper, but she was working for only room and board.
Mm.
A few days later, Ruby would bring Lorraine back to Austin to be reunited with her family. So they do film this, and then the sisters are interviewed, and they're just so happy. Sweet Ruby says, "I was so enthused. I cried. I laughed. I did everything." And they show a video of all the sweet siblings. They're seeing Lorraine for the first time and hugging her, and it's very nice.
Oh, nice.
And then we have an interview with Lorraine, and she says, "Yes, it's nice to be back. They're real nice. They've always been. They're original people that are very darling people." And as every Lost Loves reunion must have, the siblings look through old photos together. Mm-hmm. And this is filmed. Lorraine stayed in Austin for 3 months. She received her $105,000 inheritance and has since gone back to her home in Arkansas. Ruby says they're going to do all they can to just be together and love each other and include Lorraine's children and grandchildren. She says she thinks it will be real good for Lorraine and for all of them.
So, wait, do they know where the kids are?
No. So, a tiny bit of information that UM left out. When they found Lorraine, she had actually gone back to using her first name, which is Vera. Her name is Vera Lorraine, which is probably part of why they had such a hard time finding her. Yeah. I find it interesting that there was one very short clip of the interview of Lorraine. Mm-hmm. There was no explanation as to what she had been doing for the last 30 years and how she ended up in Arkansas. I also find it interesting that she decided to go back to Arkansas after the 3 months.
It was room and board.
She was working for room and board.
So when she went back to Arkansas, it wasn't her home.
Right.
Yeah. I was like, maybe she had like a really established life there and some really great friends or something. Like, I just don't know what there was for her out there.
Yeah.
But then part of me thinks, like, she probably just didn't know how to fit back into this family that she hadn't been a part of for 30 years.
Yeah.
So I don't know. We know that she had some mental health issues, and I think you can kind of see that in the reunion footage.
Yeah.
She still kind of has that, like, disconnected look. Like,
yeah.
She looks happy, but she just looks kind of like she's not really there.
Yeah.
And, like, maybe she had to be heavily medicated for whatever was going on with her. I don't know. And, you know, I'm sure she had some guilt about giving up her children and for not contacting the family for decades. I don't know. I'm sure it just wasn't as easy as we'd like to all believe.
Sure.
I would hope that the money she got gave her a little better quality of life for the remainder of her time. She died September 2nd, 1997, when she was 64 in Little Rock. And then the family did have her buried back in Austin. But all I could find in the newspapers, there were multiple postings of those notices you have to put in the paper for probate. Mm-hmm. Where they're, like, saying who it is and how they're trying to find her for this money. And that was pretty much it. But, yeah, I just thought the reunion footage was a little different. Like, why not hear Lorraine tell her story a little bit?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, clearly this aunt's or that her sisters wanted the kids in the picture, too. But who knows? Like, were those kids even adopted together? Were they...
Probably not.
All separated? It's just sad.
Yeah, and, like, why didn't we get to see the kids in the reunion footage? Like, what... Yeah. I don't know. There were just a few missing pieces that I was like, something's a little weird here. Mm-hmm. But at least they found her, and...
Yes, totally.
She was
and
okay.
Those sisters were so sweet.
Yeah.
Not all encounters end up in the news. Some are passed down from family. Some are kept hidden in journals, and some are reported on the Nightmare Society podcast. On the Nightmare Society, we share your true horror stories. Chilling accounts of home invasions, attempted kidnappings, obsessive stalkers, and even close calls with convicted murderers before they landed on a most wanted list. So come join us if you dare. Because the scariest stories are the ones that really happened.
So, Eliza, what are we covering next episode? What do you got going on?
Oh, for part two, I have a wanted segment about a Connie Con, whose name is maybe Todd Mueller.
Ugh, I thought you were going to say Connie.
I wish.
And I have a Lost Love segment of Heath Brian Vess.
Okay. Go to patreon.com/resolvemysteriespodcast if you're interested in supporting us there. If you subscribe at the $5 a month level or higher, you're going to get ad-free episodes, 2 extra episodes a month, and other goodies. To see photos we reference in the episode, follow us on Instagram at Resolve Mysteries Podcast and on Facebook and Twitter at Resolve the Pod. You can contact us at resolvemysteriespodcast.com, resolvemysteriespodcast@gmail.com, or at our P.O. Box 14005, Portland, Oregon 97293. And send us your spooky stories for an October listener short stack episode.
Spook!
Get those to us at our website or our email or snail mail. And then please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like us, please leave a 5-star review and tell a friend. And for every review that we receive, we donate $1 to an organization. And this month's organization is the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. And that's it. We'll see you next week for part 2.
All right. Bye.
Bye. We love you so.
Bye.
Keeping it spooky. Clap on 3, 1, 2, 3.
Oh.
Ugh.
It's pretty good.
That was my thought. I thought you were recording already, Eliza. Sorry. I didn't mean to rush you.
Oh, you didn't rush me. I was ready. Ew. Okay. There was just another little part of iBoogie left.
Ew. It's so disgusting. Ugh. Okay.
It's so gross because part of it is like, mm-hmm. wet and sticky, and no. the other part is dry no. and crusty.
No.
<Mm-mm. laughs> We were already grossed out. You didn't have to take it from
even like thinking about the I can't. Okay.